KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Dave Iverson. We've all heard that the children are our future, but one group of children in particular has many leaders across California very concerned. A new report from a select legislative subcommittee paints a dramatic picture of boys and men of color. The picture, as you might imagine, is pretty bleak in areas like education, health, and employment. But a new effort is underway to attack these problems from all sides, and Californians are coming together with bold ideas and fresh legislation. We'll talk to experts who put this report together and meet some young men of color working to make things better. The future of California's boys and men of color, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Dave Iverson. If there's one thing I heard over and over as a kid, it's this. You are valuable, you are important, and we need you to survive. And deep down inside, I knew the reason my family, my church, and every community group I was involved in kept telling me this. I was a smart, black boy. Sadly, I knew there was something all too rare about me, a minority male child who by all accounts would do well. And today in California, it's still by many accounts too rare. A new report from a state subcommittee reiterates that point and offers ideas for turning this trend around in California. This week, the Select Committee on the Status of Boys and Men of Color in California released a long-awaited report based on hundreds of public testimonies from all over the state. The main point? Not just that California's minority male youth are in real trouble, you may already know that, but furthermore, doing something about it in communities and in the legislature profits the whole state, minority and not, far more than it will cost. And doing nothing will cost all of us, minority males and not, far more than we can imagine. In this hour of Forum, we'll explore that report, talk to the experts behind it, and meet some young men who say these findings are true. Their lives are testament to it. We will also take your phone calls and emails in a few minutes, but first, let's hear from the Oakland lawmaker who led the select subcommittee. That is Democratic Assemblyman Sondre Swanson of Oakland. He and I discussed the report yesterday. I asked the Assemblyman what we've learned from the report.
Well, first, one of the things that we learned is that there is a tremendous amount of interest in addressing the problem, both by those that find themselves in the middle of trouble and those that are trying to assist people that find themselves in the middle of trouble. What we also have learned is that all of California should be concerned about this because all of California is paying a cost by either our inability to address these concerns or provide a solution to these concerns. Example, our state prison system the state prison budget is rapidly outpacing our budget for higher education. That's costing all Californians a lot. It is also putting California in a position to where our prison budget is totally dysfunctional. We have a 70% recidivism rate. Costs us $50,000 a year per prisoner, and 7 out of 10 just keep coming back in and reoffending. And many of those, as we know, as you referred to earlier, are young men of color. And so that speaks to the urgency of California addressing it, not only from an economic standpoint, but there are also serious moral concerns, because this population of young people, from you and the last census has shown us that from the age of 0 to 25, that population, 70% of that population are young men of color. And so California's future is going to be either successful or a failure based on how we produce this generation and how we rescue this generation from these problems. Education has been is clearly the key to solving some of these problems, but the fact that we have to make sure that we fix the broken prison system so that in fact rehabilitation takes place, and that in most other states the recidivism rate is anywhere from 20 to 30%. California is twice that number, 70%, And so we're failing to be able to find solutions to rehabilitation. And the examples that have worked other places are common sense examples. If you treat technical training, if you help someone obtain a GED, if you make sure that literacy becomes one of the priorities in your rehabilitation program, it lowers the recidivism rate, it frees up dollars, and then you can start talking about strategies, because no longer is it just a question of money, but it's a question of implementing programs.
That was Oakland Democratic Assemblyman Sondre Swanson. He chairs the Select Committee on the Status of Boys and Men of Color in California. Let's continue the conversation now with Mark Philpart. He's a senior associate at Policy Link, a social equity think tank based in Oakland. His focus is on the health issues detailed in the study. Policy Link helped coordinate the outreach that fed public suggestions into the report. Mark Philpart, good morning.
Good morning, Joshua.
Also here in studio, Jorge Ruiz de Velasco is the Director for Education, Law, and Policy at UC Berkeley's Warren Institute on Law and Social Policy. He also co-drafted and edited much of the report. Jorge, good morning.
Good morning, Joshua. Thanks for sharing your story and having us on.
Well, thank you for being here. Later on, we'll speak with two young men who also have some interesting stories to share and whose testimonies helped inform this report. And we'll take your questions and thoughts as well on what works and what does not in helping minority male youth succeed. Feel free to begin lining up on the phone lines at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us forum@kqed.org. Mark and Jorge, this is such a gigantic topic. Where do we even begin to solve this? For someone, I mean, even I, reading the report, it's got 65 policy recommendations in it on education and employment and juvenile justice and health and personal development. For the person who looks at this, minority or not, and goes, too big, can't solve it, can't even help. Where do we begin to take a bite of this? Mark, where do you think we begin with this?
I think the assemblyman had the right approach and the right frame. As he talked about the multitude of challenges facing this population, he named a whole host of issues: reentry, unemployment, low graduation rates. And it takes addressing all of those things in order to begin to make inroads to support this population. There's an analogy that says, if you touch one part of the web, you touch the whole web. And that applies to improving outcomes for boys and men of color. So starting anywhere is actually a part of the total solution.
Jorge, what do you think? Where's a good place to start?
Well, I agree with Mark. I think that one of the important things we did, were that the Select Committee did, was it held hearings in Oakland, in Los Angeles, in Fresno, out in the Coachella Valley. And it proceeded from two principles, just going right to the question you asked. One was, can we engage the people closest to the problem in real communities, both in identifying what the problem is and identifying solutions, and in taking that as an opportunity to identify real innovative practices that are going on in Oakland and Los Angeles that we can talk about today, and places that are having results. Just yesterday, I think right on the show, you had the superintendent of public schools in San Francisco talking about the challenges he's working with in San Francisco, and he took a good deal of time talking very eloquently about how they're dealing with discipline and how they're implementing restorative justice practices. And that's an excellent example of an innovative practice right here in town, and that's where we began.
So we're not just talking about governments coming in and imposing a top-down solution. You really were looking for solutions from grassroots, from the top down, from all sides
right.
of the problem.
That's right. Engaging both communities and system leaders in local communities.
I also want to make clear before we go too deep into this, I am African American, but this report is not just about black boys of color. This is about this is about black, Hispanic, Asian Pacific Islander, Native American. So I want to be very clear that that's my prism. But as you decide to call and email and chime in on our conversation, we're talking about much, much more than that. Go ahead, Mark.
And just to add to that, Joshua, this report is about boys and men of color, their families, and their communities.
So this really isn't just about people who of a particular hue. This is really about everybody in that web that you talked about.
Right.
Talk to me about the public meetings you had. According to the report, you had more than 1,750 people show up to these five public meetings in Sacramento, Oakland, L.A., Fresno, and Coachella. That must have been – not only a little overwhelming, but heartening just to see that that many people really cared about this issue and wanted to show up and speak out.
Well, I think that that was one of the most important things about the process, that there are people, there are young people in schools, in clubs, in communities that are engaged in the issue in their local communities. There are teachers, there are principals, there are system leaders who care and are trying to do creative things. But they had not, until this hearing process, had an opportunity to come together and to galvanize around an issue and around a set of solutions. And this really provided an opportunity for the superintendent of Oakland and for youth leaders in his schools and teachers and his probation folks to come together for a day to talk in a sustained way about the narrative of the issue. And that was really very empowering and galvanizing.
Now, as I said, for me at least, growing up, I heard all these conversations before and community stakeholder meetings before. It sounds like the thing that you were able to get over in this process was to actually sit everybody down together. I don't think for those of us who don't work in that aspect of the public sector, I mean, I work in a nonprofit, but I don't work in the public sector per se, how disparate and how distant, Mark, that some of these organizations are, even though they deal with the same kid who overlaps all these groups. But the kid may be the link, although they may not link to each other.
Right. The genius of the hearings was that they served as a great and powerful organizing tool. They were a catalyst for having these community conversations about changing outcomes for boys and men of color, both locally and at the statewide level. And before that, you would have different initiatives that were working in their own silos, sort of working with blinders on, if you will. In education, you know, folks were concerned about dropout rates. In the foster care system, folks were concerned about disproportionality. The hearings brought all of those people together in a really powerful way to help tell a story about the challenges that this population was facing and the opportunities that they could also benefit from.
So it sounds like part of the solution going forward is to be able to break down bureaucratic walls. These are the kinds of things that community groups can't necessarily do on their own. But if you get some government agencies to kind of look at each other eyeball to eyeball in a new way, Jorge, they might be able to realize, oh, this is how we make this work.
That's right. I mean, if you take just an individual young man, for example, he's in school, but he may also be involved in the foster care system. He might be a young dad who is working with a caseworker in the health system. He may have gotten in trouble, cycled out, have a probation officer. All of these different agencies are working with the youth, but they're not aware of each other and they're not coordinated because we don't have a youth policy system. And that is one of the things that we've tried to surface in this work, is places where organically these different people are coming together and trying to create a data system so that they can share and track information and provide a coordinated set of interventions. But it's a hard lift because they're doing it basically without resources and without a system. And we're trying to raise the awareness of what it would look like if we had a state system, a coordinating body, a body of data that would help push this work along.
Well, let's put that conversation to one young man who's affected by this and who lent his voice to the public hearings around this report. Joining us by phone is Rigo Fuentes. He lives in Coachella Valley. Rigo, good morning.
Good morning.
As I understand it, your struggles have been with finding work and with navigating the health system. Let's talk about health, first of all, just to pick a place to start. As you think about not only this report and what you shared, but kind of about your life specifically and your future specifically, talk to me about one thing that is affecting you in Coachella Valley as it relates to your access to these opportunities and what might make it better.
Well, one thing that's really affecting, like, how I live down here and, like, really causing, like, a real problem regarding health is actually, like, really access to education. And so the information that we need in order to be healthy, you know? And it's causing a lot of problems because we don't have all the information we need in order to understand that, you know, you need to exercise this amount of time a day in order to be healthy. You have to, like, these different ways to maintain a good mental health, or not just that, but just access to a good hospital.
I think that would catch a lot of people by surprise, saying you don't have enough access to that information. I mean, I think a lot of people would naively think, well, don't they talk about that on – I mean, it's on Sesame Street, for crying out loud. Doesn't everybody have access to that? But in what form would that be more helpful?
See, maybe it would be more helpful if, like, they really stress the importance of it in school more, because we do have health classes in school, but it's not necessarily, okay, you have to do this and that and everything. Okay, it's read the book, take the test, and get out of my class.
So they're not really paying attention.
Yeah, they're not really stressing the importance as, okay, you need to do this in order to have a good, healthy life and really be happy, you know?
Rigo, how would you describe your ethnic background, your nationality?
Me, I come from my parents. They're two nationalities. My dad, he's Mexican, and my mom, she's Caucasian.
Okay, so you're a mixed race Mexican American kid, born in the U.S.?
Yeah.
How would you describe what life is like as a mixed race Mexican American kid in the Coachella Valley?
See, that's a kind of hard question to ask, because there's not really one way to really describe it, because the overall general idea is just, like everybody says, it's hard. We get discriminated against. Me, personally, I'm a big guy. I don't look like the nicest person, I guess, but that when people get to meet me, they understand who I am. But at first glance, they see a Mexican-American kid, and they see, for some reason, the stereotype is troublemaker. Is somebody who's not trying to get anywhere. And that kind of like makes it extremely hard for like people like me just to live their life.
So Rigo, what do you want to do one day? Do you plan to stay in Coachella Valley or move out and move on? Or what's your dream?
Me, I want to go to college, and I want to come back to Coachella Valley. And I want to eventually I want to get into music production, and I want to end up starting something here. So kids like me have a place, something to do, something safe to do, without having to, like, risk getting in trouble, risk getting discriminated against, have some positive, feedback to help them get through their life, help them improve themselves.
Let me open the conversation up to Jorge and Mark. As you two are listening to Rigo's story, what are your reactions to what you're hearing?
Well, you know, I grew up in a small town. I was very impressed. I went to visit Coachella when we had our hearing there, and I was impressed at how much the area is like the small town I grew up in, South Texas, in Brownsville, right on the Mexican border. Two things that Rigo sort of surfaces is the lack of basic care that is available to children who live in high-poverty families. In California, that's one of every four young people, and disproportionately Southeast Asian, Black, Latino, and Native American. What you don't see in these families is regular access to health care. And so you have kids who are going right up through elementary school, high school, and they've never seen a dentist. They've never been to an eye doctor. They may have trouble reading the board, any number of other challenges that are undiagnosed because they haven't had access to that care. That's one of the opportunities that we tried to surface in the upcoming Affordable Care Act that does provide greater opportunities for access, popularly known as Obamacare. It is something that we hope to find opportunity there to bring that in a greater piece.
Pause on that for just 1 second. Rigo, does that describe you? Has it been a while since you were able to go to the doctor or you were able to go to the dentist, or have you been more fortunate in that regard?
Me personally, I've been more fortunate in that area, like getting access to like a doctor, a dentist, and everything. But like, just because I was that lucky, because I have friends that, like how he said, have never seen a dentist, an eye doctor. I have a friend who can't see past like the front. It's hard for him to see past the front of his nose, and he has never been to an eye doctor because he can't afford it. He doesn't have medical insurance. He doesn't have anything like that. And it's sad.
Two quick things, Rigo, and then I got to let you go. First of all, I forgot to ask, how old are you?
Oh, I'm 16.
Oh, so you're just a young man. You're coming up. You got your whole life to be rich and famous and successful and powerful and amazing. The last thing I wanted to ask you, and I really appreciate you sharing this with us, man. I really do. For the people who are listening to this who think, not my problem, I don't live in the Coachella Valley. I'm not Mexican-American. I will never meet Rigo Fuentes or anybody like him. What would you say to them? To people who think that your problem ain't their problem, what would you say?
Well, as not just as a Mexican-American, not just as Rigo, not just as anybody living in the Coachella Valley, but as a person, I believe one person's problem is everybody's person's problem, because no matter how far away you may be, it does affect you in some way, because when we are we're becoming the majority of the people in California, and when the majority of the people are suffering, that means the system is wrong. And that when the system is wrong, that means it's going to start affecting other people. And the more people it affects, the less our country grows.
Well said. Rigo Fuentes in the Coachella Valley. I hear they call you Bubba.
Yeah.
Well, keep your head up, Bubba. I want to hear good things from you, man. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Take care, man. We're discussing California's young men and boys of color and a new report with scores of suggestions to brighten their futures. We will get into more of those suggestions as our hour goes on. Want you to join the conversation. Plenty of room on the phone lines. Tell us what works. What does not work in this regard? What have you seen? And if this report is talking about your life, tell us what you experienced and perhaps what might have helped you out. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also leave a comment on our Facebook page. And we're on Twitter now. You can follow us at KQED Forum. And I wanted to affirm something Rigo just said in terms of California's majority-minority population. According to census data, of the people in California who are 25 years old or younger, 71% are people of color. 71% of California's young adults are people of color. About 29% are white. We're coming up on a break in just a few minutes, but I'm wondering in terms of the situation of kids like Rigo, and we're going to speak to others and meet others after the break. Mark Philpart, was there one thing that stood out for you that, you know, because this is such a huge problem, that you heard from Rigo and said, oh, this is something easy that can be done that might make a difference for him, briefly as we come up to a break?
You know, Rigo expressed a very powerful but yet simple sentiment of wanting to go to college and come back and work in music production in Coachella. To me, helping him realize his dream, that one simple thing of going to college, coming back home to work, is incredibly powerful. And starting there, I think, would add tremendous value.
Jorge, any thoughts before we head to the break?
I think that he gave a real flavor of the communities in which young people come to, and the way that those things they experience in their communities are then find their way into classroom and either accelerate or get in the way of instructional capacity in classrooms. And one of those is the isolation they feel in their communities and the trauma that they may experience. And hope we'll have a chance to talk about those too.
We certainly will. And I want us to talk solutions when we come back from
Absolutely.
The break. Some of the many suggestions in here, great policy suggestions. We're continuing our conversation about the future of young men and boys of color in California. Call us. Tell us what works, what does not work. What's your experience been? 866-733-6786. Forum@kqed.org. Comment on our Facebook page and reach us on Twitter @KQEDForum. More in a minute. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Dave Iverson. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. Welcome back to Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Dave Iverson. We're discussing the future of young men and boys of color in California. Still with us in studio are Mark Philpart of PolicyLink and Jorge Ruiz de Velasco of UC Berkeley's Warren Institute on Law and Social Policy. Please call us and join the conversation, 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can leave us a comment on our Facebook page and hit us up on Twitter. We are @KQED Forum. As we were about to go to the break, Mark Philpart, you said something occurred to you in terms of educational programs, as we heard Rigo Fuentes' story. What was that?
Well, you know, Rigo simply wants to go to college. And our college prep programming in California public schools is woefully inadequate. There are programs that could serve to strengthen the opportunities that youth like Rigo have in terms of going to college and becoming successful and being on a career track. The Advancement Via Individual Determination Program, AVID, is a college readiness system for elementary through post-secondary youth that is designed to increase school-wide learning and performance.
Elementary school for college prep.
Yes.
So starting super, super early.
Early, yes, exactly. And that's really the point. Because what we've seen is that youth are getting put on what is called a cradle-to-prison pipeline much earlier than they have been in the past. And so suspensions, expulsions, all of the things that contribute to youth being pushed out of the system or on a negative trajectory are happening much earlier and earlier.
Now, let's dig into that for a second. I don't want to gloss past that. This cradle-to-prison pipeline. Paint me a picture of the kid in the classroom, this, you know, minority boy in the classroom, and an example of the kind of thing that happens to push that pipeline along. Give me an example of one of the things.
Sure.
Or Jorge, do you have something in mind?
Well, you know, I...
Like, what goes wrong and where does it happen in the system,
so,
I guess is what I'm asking.
Okay, so I have lots of opportunities in my work to visit classrooms and schools. And one of the eye-opening things for me, because I've studied high schools most of my life, is spending time in elementary schools and discovering that one of these the ground zero for suspensions happens to be in kindergarten. So what happens is you have... in a very diverse community of Oakland, say, for example, you have young people who have very rich experiences. They have exposure to preschool. They are socialized with other children. And they come to school with numeracy skills and with phonemic awareness. So how to sound out letters, what the sounds should be like.
So they basically get letters and numbers.
Right,
basic
exactly.
Skills.
Then you also have kids who have been in public housing, who've been in dangerous neighborhoods, who have seen horrible things that we don't normally see. There have been 600 homicides among young people in California in 2010, the vast majority of which have happened in Oakland and Los Angeles neighborhoods. Young people see this and they come to school traumatized by that, even if it didn't happen to themselves, if it happened to an uncle or an aunt or a friend or a brother. And they also have been very isolated. They live in neighborhoods where it's not safe to go out and play, where it's not safe to socialize with your neighbors because your parents don't know them.
So it sounds like what you're getting at, and I hate to cut you short. We've got a lot of good comments we want to get to. It sounds like what you're getting at is that these men and boys of color come to the classroom
exactly
with experiences that will color everything they do in the classroom.
Absolutely.
And the staff there is not really ready to deal with it. So rather than deal with it, you're going to detention.
That's absolutely right. They come in and all of a sudden in kindergarten, there's kicking and biting and hair pulling. And for the teacher who may not be prepared to deal with that diversity, a suspension or moving out of the classroom is sometimes the first response.
So does that mean we excuse the behavior?
No. You know, that's one of the big fallacies here, that there are people who are for discipline and against discipline. Every child, all of us, needs to learn to internalize discipline in order to be successful. And it's just a matter of how do you do that successfully? And separating kids from the classroom is often not the way to do it, not in kinder.
We're going to dive into calls and emails now. We've got so many. Thank you all for being part of a conversation. I just want to throw in one statistic that comes at the beginning of the education part of this lengthy report. It says, as early as kindergarten, nearly 25% of African-American boys are already convinced that they lack the ability to succeed in school. That is three times more than their white counterparts. One out of four black boys, when they get to kindergarten, are already convinced that they will not make it in school. 866-733-6786. Let's go to Michael in Danville. Michael, thank you for your patience. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you.
What's on your mind?
I wanted to know if any of the testimony or any of the policy prescriptions addressed the importance of intact families and particularly the role of fathers and how we might, you know, try to enhance that. And I'd take my response off the air.
Thank you, Michael. Much appreciated. Any conversation about families, particularly fathers? I grew up in a single-parent household. I was mostly raised by my mother, but I always had a lot of black male role models around me, and I was always told why. It was always very clear to me. What did you find out in terms of the role of mentorship? And particularly parental mentorship, Mark, excuse me.
Yes, great question. one of the things that we found is that your experience, Joshua, is a very common one, that more and more these boys and men of color are being raised by single women, and households are being female led, and these youth are in situations where they lack the number of role models like that you had. You know, they grow up with a dearth of male role models, and the unfortunate thing is that the systems don't offer them any support or mentorship in that regard either. And so one of the things that we found, and I think one of the things that we've tried to stress, is that strengthening families, connecting to different relatives is important, right? We talk about foster care. So even in situations where the young boy or young man is out of the home, it's still important for him to be connected to relatives and to male role models, CASA workers who are trained to understand their background and where they might be coming from.
CASA workers?
CASA, court-appointed special advocates.
Okay.
So, you know, we've encouraged a lens that supports this idea that fathers are important, that families are important in terms of raising any youth. And so what we've tried to do with our policy recommendations is weave that throughout.
Jorge, I know we've spoken a little bit about your experience growing up in Brownsville. Mark, I'm sure this resonates with you also. You're from South Central L.A., is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Talk about how your experience informed your view of this issue, because you've seen,
yes,
a lot of these issues growing up, too.
I certainly did. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, and I grew up during the civil unrest, during the Rodney King beating. And so I was immediately influenced by these issues of race and poverty and gender. And, you know, growing up also without a father in the home, for the latter part of my adolescence, you know, these influences are profoundly powerful. And if you don't have the support, if you don't have stable family members who you can rely on, the weight of all of this can be overbearing for a youth. And it's no surprise that people act out or people have trouble or difficulty.
We've been getting some really good comments online. I want to share one comment from the web. Alan writes, it's a little bit lengthy, but I'll read as much of it as I can. I heard you say that this isn't just about African-American youths and men, referring to me, mm-hmm, but about all youth and men of color, not mentioning white people. So who are you talking to? What do you think is the part that should be played by the average middle-aged white guy, other than the ethical or moral questions that arise about fairness and responsibility for the community? If the general population of quote-unquote non-colored people have any responsibility, how would you engage them?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting thing.
Because other than the fact that color is an anachronism, which we don't really use anymore, but whatever. I knew what you meant. Go ahead.
You know, we have been very focused on the intersection of race and gender in this work, race, ethnicity, and gender. But there is a larger and global issue around boys broadly. In almost all the industrialized countries, girls are beginning to outpace and do better than boys generally. Girls are now the majority in law school. Girls are now doing better in admission to our top universities. Many universities are having to have affirmative action for boys broadly just to have a gender balance class. And part of that is, you know, like you, I also grew up in a single-parent home, parented mostly by my mom and grandmother. And while it's very important to have male role models, I think moms and dads both teach their boys what it is to be a man and how that sort of then mediates sort of coping skills that matter. So, for example, in order to be successful in today's world where we're more crowded and more competitive and where we work closely together with people we have to compete with, it's important to have empathy, to be in touch with your feelings, to cooperate, to be patient.
So to this well-meaning white guy who wrote this email.
Yes, that has nothing to do with race at all. But the important point is that all those qualities I just mentioned, empathy, cooperation, being patient, being in touch, they are not thought to be masculine qualities. Mm. Or we don't teach our boys that often wind up teaching boys that, that being cold is a masculine quality. And that is not a very strong coping skill in the real world.
So that's the kind of thing that I think everybody can model. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Clarence, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
What's on your mind?
I'm involved with helping children, the African-American Male Achievement Program. Mm-hmm. They started here in the city of Oakland. I do reading, and then I volunteer whenever I can with my grandson's school. And what I find is really common is just the detriment to me of our youth, especially boys, not just even African American. I even see them with Latino boys because they have an issue with the language. You have teachers who are just not culturally aware about what it takes to educate a lot of our kids of color. I mean, they have no clue. They might have credentials up the yang, but they don't have a clue what it takes to educate.
Give me an example, Clarence, of one thing that you would like to see them do better at, briefly, that would make it easier for these boys.
I think one thing would do better if they would just simply, a lot of teachers, they don't listen. You know, a lot of the people in the community say, you know, if you do this, this will better help our sons. They just don't listen. Many of the teachers are kind of very impatient. You know, instead of dealing with the child, and maybe they have too many kids, 25, 22 children, they will send a kid out, you know, and many times he's African-American or a Latino boy, you know, and many times these kids, it's not their fault. A lot of times these kids, they're smart, they finish their work early, and then they're bored, like my grandson. Once he's done, he'll start talking.
Right.
You know, he's just not busy enough. And at the beginning of the year, last year, they had sent him out. The first week of school, he had been out, kicked out of class about 8 times.
Wow. Hey, Clarence, we got to move on to the next call, but that is a good point to try to have a little more sensitivity to what these kids are dealing with. And it's a point that I believe Jorge made also. Thank you for that call. Let's go to Leah in Berkeley, who's been waiting quite a while. Leah, thank you for your patience and good morning.
Hi there. One statistic that I think is really important in this conversation, too, is I have read that 80% of juvenile delinquents have learning disabilities that have not been addressed. And my son is one of the kids with a learning disability. And, you know, I'm a professional, and my husband is. But with our Berkeley School District, it took a ton of pushing and work and being really, really, really aggressive and assertive to get his learning disability addressed. Mm-hmm. And I know if I would not have done it, he still would not be reading, and he probably would, be totally disengaged. And, you know, there's, they said, 20% of kids have type of dyslexia, with a huge number.
Hey, Leah, that's a good point. Let me put that to our guests in terms of learning disabilities. Did you find any overlap with that in terms of the statistics?
Yes, there are. She's absolutely right. Both all the way through elementary school and into high school, you find that kids with learning disabilities, first of all, sometimes their learning disabilities are not diagnosed or adequately diagnosed. So kids who have not been to an eye doctor may be thought to just be resistant, rather than to have a real disability or a handicap that's getting in the way. And so you do find that they get frustrated, they act out, and they wind up being treated harshly and disciplinary, disproportionately so. Another area that where there's a great deal of lack of data, but where we are finding more anecdotal data, is that gay youth, particularly gay, black, and Latino, and Southeast Asian boys, are also disproportionately found in juvenile detention. and in disproportionately in some places placed into alternative instructional like continuation high schools and other places like that, in part to protect them. Because they suffer from a kind of dual isolation within their communities.
That sounds like another layer of this that is worth addressing. That was one of the things I had to address when I discovered that I was black and gay. That was like an additional layer of, doggone it, I was just getting good at being black.
Too stressed.
And now, right, and now I have to learn how to do something all over again, something brand new. Let's get another perspective from a young man in Oakland. Michael Muscadine works with Communities United for Restorative Justice. He's also very involved in urban beautification projects in Oakland, and his voice was among those that helped inform this report. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
I want to focus on your experiences with the criminal justice system, if we could. Specifically, you've had some dealings with some of the anti-gang policies, the gang injunctions in Oakland, and this, as I understand it, has made it tough for you to find work these days and to just kind of get on your feet the way you'd like to.
Yeah, I've been in criminal justice as a teen and as a young adult. I see that there's nothing there for us. Like, they always talk about probation is there to help us. But when I was in probation, not one probation officer gave me no programs or anything. All they did was check up on me, making sure I wasn't staying out of trouble.
I understand that you had trouble with applying for a job once. Is that right, where your criminal history kind of came back to bite you in the end after you had already landed this job?
Yes, that's there's applications that always ask you if you have been convicted of a crime or been in jail to check a box, no or yes. And I was always checking yes, and nobody was never coming back. I'm like, hey, what's going on? So I'm always out there looking for work. So there's one time, I filled out an application. I was like, whoa, I'm going to just put no. I checked no, then I got a call back within a week. And they hired me, and I was working. Then within a week, they found out that I lied on my application. They asked me why I lied. I said, because if I put yes, you would have never even looked at my application. You would have threw it away and probably just ripped it up. Mm-hmm. I was just the first one I called. They said, Mike, you're a good worker. We like you, but, we can't just have you in this position because you lied in your background. I was like, I was upset, and they just told me to come back after I get off probation and take care of everything.
And there are some suggestions I should mention in the report, in the section that has to do with employment and also the section on juvenile justice that are designed to help young men like yourself. Talk to me about what you see in Oakland that gives you hope. Sometimes I have to shut the news off, and I work in the news because I hear some of the stories that come out of Oakland all the time, and I just know that there are more affirming stories than this. What do you see as it relates to young men like you who are your age, who are young men of color, who are really – they may be on the struggle and on the grind, but they're making it. What do you see in Oakland that gives you hope?
I see hope as a community coming together right now. Like, really, all of us from all different nationalities, different backgrounds, no matter what we are or what we believe in, we're coming together and organizing against – what these politicians in the city of Oakland want for us, because it takes the community to save itself and to better itself. So that gives me a lot of hope for us collaborating together. And, I haven't seen that, lately, but there's young, old, middle-aged people. So I got a lot of hope in that, and I hope it stays that way.
Michael, how old are you?
I'm 26.
26. And what are your plans someday? Where do you want to go?
Right now, I just want to get back into school. Just keep on organizing in the Fruitvale District in Oakland and bettering my community and beautifying it and working with the things that do work here.
So your focus right now is on getting your education and digging your heels in where you are?
Yes.
All right. Well, I certainly wish you the best of luck. Michael Muscadine of Oakland, thanks for making time for us.
All right. Thank you, sir.
We got a lot of great comments from the web. Jorge, Jorge or Mark have any quick reactions before we move on? Mark?
Yes. So what Michael didn't mention is that he's part of an effort to end gang injunctions in Oakland. And he's been working with several folks through Communities United for Restorative Youth Justice, a community-based organization there, to organize both community members and systems leaders to find alternative forms to public safety, to promote public safety in the area. And I think, you know, he touched on it when he said this is one of the things that gives him hope. And it's also one of the recommendations that we've made in our report is to, you know, find community-based alternatives to gang intervention.
Let's speak to another call. I want to try to get in as many comments as we can as our time is running out. Ayana, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Is it Ayana or Iana?
Iana.
I'm sorry. What's on your mind, Iana?
I was just wondering, in addition to talking about programs investing in youth, if the report also has something to say about removing protections for those actively harming young men of color. And I'm thinking specifically about repealing the Officer's Bill of Rights that protects officers who murder young men of color like Alan Bluford. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Iana. Jorge or Mark, can either of you speak to that, to the criminal justice aspect of perhaps the deck being stacked in favor of law enforcement in ways that some people would find unfair? Or is that kind of beyond the scope of this particular report?
Well, you know, that is a little beyond the scope of this report. I think, though, we've reached a point that the sheer number of young people who are falling into the juvenile justice, criminal justice realm, that more and more police chiefs, probation chiefs are standing up and saying we've got to change the way that we do business and that we work with schools. I wanted to go back a little bit to Mike's comments on the radio. He pointed out something really important about, you know, a lot of kids, most, you know, teens get in trouble. But if you don't have a web of people around you to help you out, making a mistake can be a life sentence in a really important respect. Most kids who get in trouble wind up not being incarcerated. They wind up on probation for a little while. Or the average sentence, I think, is something around 60 days. But it can be, as Mike pointed out, a life sentence, because once you're out without help and guidance, employers don't want you. They're afraid of you. Schools don't want you back.
Right.
It's very hard to get back into a comprehensive school once you've been incarcerated. And what a lot of these young people need is people to catch them immediately on exit and help them reenter through job training, mentoring, and work with the capacity of these schools to receive them back.
And I don't think a lot of kids realize that until it is a little bit too late. We're getting a lot of comments from the web. We've gotten a few kind of along this strand. Michael writes, why should the 29 behaving kindergarten children have to be subjected to the kicking and biting of a child who won't behave? I'm not hearing anyone talk about family responsibility. I was raised by a single mom, but she did her best to be responsible and to make me responsible for my behavior. Plenty of families of all colors are raising successful children. Why are these children successful? Mostly because of their families, I believe. We got another comment that asks about where are these kids' parents? Aren't they the first responders? Why should folks like us? I'm a woman of color as well. My husband abandoned me and left me with two daughters. I worked my tail off for my daughters, went to Ivy League schools. Why should society pitch in before the parents will? Mark Philpart, why shouldn't we just say, okay, parents first, and then when you're at the end of your rope, then we'll dive in?
You know, this is a challenge that we continuously face in our American narratives. You know, the pull yourself up by your bootstraps philosophy and you know, the philosophy that I think we've been trying to preach of a loving, caring system that supports youth at all stages of development. I think one of the challenges is that for families in communities of concentrated poverty, there are so many more negative forces that impede and act as barriers to being successful that you really are hamstrung in terms of how well you can parent, how well you can be successful as a youth in school or otherwise. And it's this interconnected web, as I mentioned earlier, that tends to be the penultimate challenge for people. And it's not just about behavior as a kid or parenting practices per se, but it's about all of the things that influence behaviors. all of the things that get in the way of people being able to have the opportunity to behave in a way that is a positive social norm.
We're almost out of time here. I just want to touch very briefly on where this effort goes from here. And for people who want to dig in right now, who want to help out, some suggestions for where to help. We've only got just about 30, 45 seconds left. Very briefly, where does this go from here? And people who are motivated from hearing this, how can they dive in?
I think that the Select Committee is going to continue its work, and I think they're going to we've garnered a lot of – we have a report with 65 some odd recommendations, and more and more people in various parts of the state are going to use that as a touchstone to come together to think creatively. It's just the beginning of a conversation about where to go and discovering where the gems are.
People should visit allianceforbmoc.org. That's allianceforboysandmenofcolor.org, and join our website.
Allianceforbmoc.org. Thank you both. Way too much of a topic to discuss in a full hour, but we're glad you joined us. Mark Philpott of Policy Link, Jorge Ruiz de Velasco of UC Berkeley, also Rigo Fuentes and Michael Muscadine for sharing their stories. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
And thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, and Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Dave Iverson. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.